The Ringer's music critic Rob Harvilla curates and explores 60 iconic songs from the 90s that define the decade. Rob is joined by a variety of guests to break it all down as they turn back the clock. Check out 60 Songs That Explain the 90s exclusively on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from sports exploration and green energy to delivering pizza and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, he's just been cast in Succession Season 3. It's Andy Greenwald!
Cat's out of the bag!
Yeah! You're playing Pat Riley!
I want to join a team where there's room for me to work within the offense, you know what I mean? And Succession, a little thin cupboard this year, right?
We're going to talk a little bit about Succession's barrage of casting announcements, Andy. We're recording this on Thursday. This will probably go up Thursday night, Friday morning, because we recap Top Chef. So we'll have obviously the Top Chef episode discussed in this episode of the pod. We're also we feature today a lovely interview with Rob McElhenney, who everybody knows from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Mythic Quest. And Mythic Quest's second season is coming, I believe, on Friday, so people can start to check that out. It is on par, if not better, than the first season, which I loved. And it was really cool to chat with Rob because, you know, it was one of those things where I think you go into it and you're like, oh, this guy is going to be like this comic genius on the pod or this incredibly funny person. And he is very funny, but really, really thoughtful about the making of the show and what went into making,
through your mind every day before you record with me. We were like, I'm so excited. This guy's so funny. And then you find out that I've got layers.
It's true. So really cool chat with him. I hope people stick around and listen to my conversation with Rob McElhenney. Andy, how are you doing?
Great. Great.
Yeah, I'm great too. Thanks for asking.
I assumed because I'm looking at your face.
And I wanted to go through a couple of news items before we got to Top Chef today. And the first one being what we just joked about, which was this sort of every 3 days getting to find out that another pretty famous person is going to be on Succession Season 3. Succession Season 3 is now up there with the other HBO show that is like the casting announcement favorite, which is Showtime, the Lakers show that they're doing, both of which will apparently feature Adrian Brody. Adrian Brody is joining Succession Season 3, playing an activist investor, which I guess is kind of like, is that like Carl Icahn? Is that the guy? Is he an activist investor?
I guess it depends what he's active for. Like, is he a frisky investor or is he himself?
He just likes buying old school American companies and making them great again, right?
Right. I guess an activist investor could also be like an Elon Musk type, right?
He's more of like a founder dude, I think. So the other casting announcement that they made this week, I believe, was Alexander Skarsgård is joining the show as a, I mean, honestly, it does sound like
a passive investor?
Or it sounds like my ultimate boss, Daniel Ek, is who he's playing. He's playing a tech founder and CEO. So Skarsgård, Adrian Brody, they joined Sana Lathan, who's was already announced. She's playing a lawyer on the show. This is definitely like file under takes, I don't really believe.
Can't wait.
Is there enough ball for everybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the show is so juicy. You know what I mean? There's just so much stuff there. Not just within the family, but within the larger world, and especially after the last year we've had, I think there's more than enough reps for everyone. And I would say that file this under takes that we can revisit when the show comes back. I think that we would have noticed this anyway had season 3 filmed and then debuted as it was intended to last year.
Yeah, but I think August is when it usually comes back, right?
Right.
Right.
But I do think that this isn't the case with every show, but I do think that the enforced break that Succession has had to weather will actually increase its presence in the culture. I think it increases its stature. Mm-hmm. I think that we saw this coming after the first season into the second season, and then the Emmys reflected it as well. This is HBO's primetime show right now. This is the show that is it's a uniter. People adore it. Comedy people love it. Drama people love it. This is the show people in this town and other towns like to talk about and watch. And I just have the feeling like these kind of like, oh, just casually dropping Oscar winners into the show.
Yeah.
This is kind of an exciting run for it. And I just feel like when it comes back, it will have that energy that other returning greats have had when they've come back from great seasons. But I think it's going to feel a little bit like what happened with Breaking Bad when it was suddenly, you know, just recognized as one of, if not the greatest show on TV, mostly because of people catching up in the interim. I think a lot of people have probably joined the board, so to speak, during this break.
Yeah, I would imagine that that Brody and Skarsgård are going to be doing Cherry Jones style 3-episode arcs, maybe. You know what I mean? Like, that's sort of the ingenious part about this show is that it employs pretty old school ideas where you can bring in somebody to do a little bit of a run like that, like the way they do on Law and Order or Grey's Anatomy or any other show you can think of over the years, and get them in and out. And you know, I don't know necessarily that Adrian Brody's character is going to change the direction of the show necessarily. I think it would be more like there's a lot of activity going on around the company, and these two guys are factors in it. You mentioned HBO, and this is the show that this is their kind of golden goose right now. There were pictures released, publicity stills from House of the Dragon, which is the Game of Thrones spinoff, the Game of Thrones prequel that they're in production with Matt Smith starring all manner of Targaryens and Hightowers involved. And obviously, if it's called House of the Dragon, you can imagine some flappy things coming. And I thought it was interesting that they did not have a Paddy Considine picture. I don't know if he's playing a dragon or not. You know, it doesn't seem... Sir, are you a dragon? But yeah, I'm asking another grown man if he has a reaction to Game of Thrones publicity stills.
Do you think it's one of those things? So I just saw online Richard Shepard, great director, nice guy, was... talking about how his first film came out, it was called like The Linguini Incident or something, came out like 30 years ago. And he was 25 years old. He got a movie set up and he sent a script to David Bowie's agents being like, would Mr. Bowie consider playing this character part? Because I know he's interested in doing some acting at the moment. And then the script came back being like, Mr. Bowie would like to star in the movie if that's interesting to you. And so he directed David Bowie in his first movie. And I wonder if Paddy Considine was sent the script being like, would you like to play... you know, Horatio Targaryen, like Grand Vizlord of the fucking keep or whatever. And he was just like, Mr. Considine, thanks to you for the submission. He would like to play, you know, Flamor, the giant dragon. And then what do you do? You got to be like, well, Mr. Considine wants to play the dragon.
Yeah.
I'm into it.
I want to play Nikola Jokic, dragon of the Waystar Royco company.
So massively overrated. No, so I think... you're asking me my reaction to 2 still photos of people with blonde wigs standing on cliffs.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, Chris, there's no way that anyone's reaction to these photos is just going to reinforce the narrative they're already carrying within them. And so because of that,
that's a good point.
Honest with you. I mean, if you're excited, if you were really pumped to see anything Targaryen related, you're going to be like, great, they're back on the cliffs. Looks good. No notes. My thing was, what are we doing again? And that's not HBO's problem yet. That's not any of the people involved in House of the Dragon's problem yet, because we are on, to quote the great Ross, we are on a break, you know, from
I thought you
Game
were
of Thrones.
Quote Rick Ross
or Doug
like,
Ross from
I was
early
like,
season
Rick
ER.
Ross have a song called "We Were on a Break"?
No, I don't think Rick Ross, at least in terms of my understanding of his oeuvre, he rarely expresses concern about, you know, traditional romantic role play.
That was not a line in mafia music, I don't think. Yeah.
None of mafia music. 1, 2, 3, 4, none of the greats.
Yeah.
So it's probably not their problem yet, but I do think, and this is something that we've been kind of teasing about and talking about, and you know, it's been underlying our conversations. It's gonna be more of a hard reboot, I think, to get people on board with this than may have been the case had the spinoff been locked and loaded and ready to go within a year of Game of Thrones going off the air.
We had this conversation offline, just so people know how 100 we keep it. Like, if you want to know if Andy and I are sending each other concern troll texts about IP when we're not on the clock, it does happen. And yeah. I'm really, really fascinated to see whether or not the market is still there. I know it will be. I know. I mean, I guess I just wonder whether or not the market will be there to make this a mainstream show and a mainstream sensation and a cultural sensation the way the original show was, the way the Mothership show was. I have that same question about Lord of the Rings. I think watching this happen for Mandalorian would suggest that there's certainly a pathway to have it. Whether or not there is anything as cute as Baby Yoda in Game of Thrones, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on whether or not you chalk up all of Mandalorian's success to Baby Yoda and that cameo at the end.
Hot Pie was pretty cute in the middle seasons of Game
of
Thrones.
Yeah, that's true.
He's a nice guy.
That's true.
The thing that I think, and this is sort of what we were texting about, that I think is interesting, is it will be a real-time test of what audiences' appetites are and how diversified they've become in terms of the overall umbrella of genre entertainment. Because, to your point, Lord of the Rings was a phenomenon in movie theaters for a limited amount of time, a couple of years. People had obviously loved and read the books and treasured them for decades, so there was a built-in fan base. And they were presented on such a scale that at that time still felt pretty novel. Oh, we're taking this seriously. We're pouring money into it and putting effects to the degree that we've never seen before. Good actors are coming aboard, et cetera, et cetera. Game of Thrones was genre-y and fantasy, but it also was, as you're saying, the gateway drug for people who would watch The Sopranos to also watch a show that had magic in it.
Yeah,
or whatever.
People saying like that. It's like the other shows you like. It's just got like people have swords and there's dragons.
I know that sometimes we still play the card of, look, we're just a couple of guys who can't believe there's an X-Men movie. That ship has pretty much sailed now. There has been so many years of constant barrage that now our understanding of entertainment is the idea that these superheroes are TV, they are movies, that they are all ages entertainment. That's baked in now. You know, we don't need to have that argument anymore because we're about to have like six Spider-Men in a single movie. You know what I mean? I'm not sure if the mainstream audience is as bought in to swords and sorcery as they are capes and shields. Maybe it's all one thing, but I'm not sure that it is.
Argument for House of Dragon is basically that there is some of that kind of, if you are an Arden fan and you have done all this research and you've read about these characters, you've read the books, like you will probably go into it with the same enthusiasm and anticipation that people went into Game of Thrones, where you were sitting with somebody who had read the books and they would just be like, man, just you fucking wait. This dinner is not going to go well. And I think that is exciting. I guess what I'm really curious about is, not so much whether or not the show is good or not, that'll be determined by factors that have nothing to do with us, is how it's received, how it's processed, how patient people are with it, and all these other factors that I think have changed over the 10 years.
The show's going to do really well right from the start. It's probably going to be good. I don't want to suggest otherwise.
Yeah, I think so.
I do think if we are keeping on our, keep it 100 concern troll hats on, the specific conditions of the Game of Thrones show were pretty unique in that you had a bunch of obsessive fans who were baked in and bought in from the beginning. And part of their thrill was not just watching newbies discover how cool and insane some of these storylines would be. It was that ultimately all of us, noobs and veterans united, were on the same journey headed towards the unknown. They knew a lot of what was going to happen and they were excited to see it made flesh or CGI, but they didn't know what it all meant yet. They were excited. They had theories about R and L and all that, but we were all in the dark about the final destination.
Oh, I forgot all about R and L.
Oh, you'd never forget. But the thing is with prequels, it's a lot of the excess knowledge. I mean, people will be excited to be like, oh, I've heard about that Targaryen, or how great it is to finally see this festival or this battle. Apologies to Mallory and Jason, who could have filled in those blanks for me. But towards what end? it is a problem with these large narratives, and it's the one that we come up against with Star Wars all the time, which was all the stories that landed were Skywalker stories. And then what is it after that, you know? And so we'll see if there is still enough unwritten mystery or future baked, you know, inside of the George Martin's world. There probably is, but
probably
it'll be interesting to see.
One last thing. So as everybody I'm sure is aware by now, Loki is coming, is the next MCU show that's coming in June, early June, I believe. And it was
getting
just
earlier,
announced it was supposed to be June 11th, and now it has been moved to June 9th, and it will be going on Wednesdays going forward. And the word is that it's still going to be a midnight aired show. So it will go up as Tuesday turns into Wednesday. I think this is interesting, actually.
Because so Feige knows we record on Thursdays?
I think he's just like, these guys, you know, they're chasing Top Chef all spring. Let's give them something to talk about this
summer. One works harder than those two.
I think it's interesting. Obviously, they're moving off of Fridays, I think, because of the anticipation that there will be movies again and that there will be movies in theaters and people will be like, Friday, it's time to go to the movies. I can't stay home and watch Loki. The flip of this is that I do think it is more difficult for most people to watch a TV show on Wednesday morning or Wednesday afternoon than it is Friday morning or Friday afternoon. Typically, like in my experience, the work week softens on Friday. Like you can kind of maybe cut out a little early. Maybe you can do something in the morning. Maybe there's like some things you can do. Also, maybe people are a little bit more willing to stay up late on a Thursday night because Friday is not going to be that taxing. So I find it interesting that they're going to put this up Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, and that everybody is just kind of going to be in the middle of their work week or whatever. And that kind of like, which can I look at Twitter for the next 2 days until I see what happens in Loki? Because I don't know. I think I've harped on this a lot, but I do find that the lack of clarity or the lack of sort of collective viewing with these MCU shows is like one of the only flaws I find with like the way that they've rolled these out. Obviously it's working very well for them. So they don't need my advice. Any thoughts on the Wednesday move for them?
Well, I think that it's hard for us because we see everything through the prism of when we're recording, but also we do, because we are plugged in professionally, think about the success metric for shows based on online chatter or clicks or articles and you know, driven. And so if that does still have any relevance in the larger world, Wednesday's better because then there's 2 days of blog posts and chatter, you know, during the work week before it just sort of vanishes into the weekend. Because of the way Disney Plus is set up, they have limitless amounts of data. They know exactly when people are watching it and what it means. And I'm sure they're very happy with what they've seen. I don't think they would, it's hard to imagine WandaVision or Falcon doing better, you know, at least in terms of the opaque sense of better, since we don't have the data, had they been on a different day. But so I as much as I do want to overthink it, I think that you nailed it with your first observation. Fridays are for movies again. You know, they just had their, you know, they're big, like, hey, everybody, let's go back to the movies that I'm still weeping over. You know, it was just very meaningful to me. So,
that was so weird.
It was. I thought it was cool. Salma Hayek was on a horse.
I know, but you had like 13 weeks of being like, man, I may have, this stuff is pretty corny. And then you just came bursting through the wall like the Kool-Aid man being like, Stan Lee is speaking to me about family.
Well, Stan Lee didn't narrate the footage of like the GLC bombing. You know what I mean? If he'd been like, we are one people, Carly, then I maybe would have had a different reaction.
Let's.
Here's why I'm excited about Loki. Last thing, Chris, I'll just say it. It just looks fun. That's part of it too. I'd like this show to be funny and fun.
Yeah, I'm thrilled for this show. I can't wait. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll do Top Chef. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, Can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
Alrighty, Andy, here we are, back to Stumptown. This episode of Top Chef Portland, I found kind of frustrating.
Oh, wow, coming in with something. Okay, talk about quickfire.
Well, I'll start from the end, because that's where I kind of got frustrated. I'm looking for a little bit of historical context here from you. So if you can think of some incidents where like this is being corrected, maybe my brain is just like mush and I just associate every Top Chef season with one another and I don't have like an idea about this. But it seemed to me that this was the wrong challenge to do a double elimination on, both in terms of the sort of greater purpose of the challenge, which was sort of obviously paying tribute to the ingredients and the processes of Indigenous peoples and Native Americans, and also just like the level of cooking that obviously we saw in that challenge. It was finale-esque in the sense that the thing that's what's going to send two people home was going to be a really like a marginal error. Now, whether or not you call what happened with Gabriel and Nelson a marginal error, or whether you think it's like a cardinal sin to cook fish too hard, that's up for debate. But I kind of wish this was one of those things where maybe someone in like the whether it's producers or whether it's like while they're doing it, obviously once they get the ball rolling, they can't really take it back that this is going to be a double elimination. But I think as evidenced by whatever this Last Chance Kitchen situation is that they pull at the end of the episode, and Andy and I are recording this on Thursday afternoon, so we haven't had a chance to see Last Chance Kitchen yet, so we don't know how they do Gabriel and Nelson / what happens with Jamie in relation to those two. But I just thought like this is one where I think like either A, have a single elimination, or B, like I don't know. I wasn't happy with the way that this worked out.
I hear you, but I would say that means the show is succeeding as a competition show, that you feel that way.
Yeah.
Going into it, there was no way of knowing. I mean, this was really hard. Really, really, really hard challenge. So I think going into it, there was no way of knowing that almost everyone would do so well that it would come down to ticky-tack, you know, missed notes or slightly, you know, technical stuff. There was very high likelihood that a team would just completely, more than one team would completely crash and burn, which wasn't the case, which made for, you know, a pretty exciting and satisfying episode, I think. The reason why I think this was a good choice for a double elimination, which generally I'm not a fan of, but you know, when they are tying in the drama with a Last Chance Kitchen, sudden salvation, whatever, you sort of see why they're doing it to keep things fresh and keep people on their toes, et cetera, et cetera. The reason why I think this was a good challenge for that was because if you're doing a surf and turf teamed up challenge, the temptation to hide behind one strong half of a dish is enormous. You know, if you have, I mean, these pairings were absurd on paper. Was it antelope and I mean, I don't even have it in front of me, but
yeah, no, I mean, there was among others, we had a venison with a sturgeon and caviar. Gabe and Dawn did bison with catfish, but they didn't fry the catfish. Maria and Byron did like a salmon with like a mole. I can't remember what their other protein was, but there was like, these were tough combinations.
And so there's a version of this where it's a single elimination where someone does a perfectly cooked piece of rabbit, and then someone does an interesting smelt dish, and then if one is good, and then that person goes home, and it's just cut and dried. So this forced collaboration in a way, so you couldn't just isolate yourself and hide behind your own dish, which I think created better combinations on the plate. It didn't necessarily produce friction, sparks, you know, which again is where the show has been heading, and I think I end up saying this every week, but I'm cool with that. I really like the show more when the contestants respect each other and aren't, no one particularly is bullying or throwing anyone under the bus. So I hear you, but I also think that we are headed towards, as you said, Chris, like we haven't seen Last Chance Kitchen. I don't think it would matter necessarily as much as we did. What they will probably do is one of those three-headed play-in tournaments that they've done before, mm-hmm. where there's a two-part challenge.
The winner
first challenge
of,
eliminates one yeah, of the this, people, yeah. and then the next person walks in. I also have a pretty strong sense, and people who are listening to this on Friday after Last Chance Kitchen has aired can feel free to roast me about it, although not as hard as they roasted that steelhead, that it won't reveal the winner, that the winner of
and then
the Last Chance Kitchen will
Thursday,
walk into the kitchen next week.
In.
That said, if you want my veteran opinion, and again, they're always two steps ahead of me, so they may have doctored this so that everyone would assume this. Next week on Top Chef, they show Tom or Padma reintroducing someone to the kitchen and everyone seems thrilled, mm-hmm. which makes me think it's probably not Gabriel, but they all kind of seem to like each other. So maybe that was just a
yeah,
excited
I mean, I
reaction
think
as opposed
there was,
to
it, Gabriel's gotten an edit that would suggest he is not the most popular guy, you know, and that, or that at least he's difficult to work with in team competitions at least. And, you know, even there's references to him being an asshole at the end of the episode, lovingly,
but in a loving way.
Yeah, in a loving way. And then like there's like a shot where it's like obviously when Gabriel and Nelson are walking off, like everybody's kind of got their arm around Nelson, but Gabriel is like solo, like going out, probably because he's like, I'm going.
That's my guy. Can't walk.
Yeah, right.
Nelson is leaving the field like Albert Pujols is leaving the Angels locker room today.
So
you know
second
what I mean?
Straight like, season where we've had like basically an injury on this show. Like Gregory's back last season.
I'm worried about Nelson. It seems just like a beautiful person. He yeah. seems so chill. He seems so kind. Like I would just like to hang out and be around him. He doesn't even need to cook. Don't even stand up, Nelson. You know what I mean? But like kitchen repetitive stress injuries are real in the kitchen. And my guy needs some work done, you know? Like maybe they don't want a feature in Food and Wine magazine. You know what I mean? Maybe they just want to go visit a sports science.
They want
Institute.
Dr. James Andrews to do the knee surgery. Yeah.
Yes. I think that's exactly right. I don't think that's so far fetched.
Here's another, just for the sake of conversation, question for you.
Okay.
What would you have said if I had said we should have had the elimination challenge essentially be the quickfire? Although obviously you would have to tweak it because you couldn't do a quickfire with all these different components probably, but have the mushrooms be the elimination challenge.
I think this was a successful elimination challenge because it was, I mean, I'll just say it plain. I mean, surf and turf is dumb. I just think as a concept, do you ever actually had it? It's just usually dumb. It's just like someone was just like, well, I can't decide between these two luxurious ingredients, so I'll have both on a plate.
I just always remember the moment in Midnight Run where they're on the plane. You've seen Midnight Run, I assume. And they're on the plane. And De Niro's like, what are you going to have for dinner? And he's just like, I'm not hungry. He's like, well, why don't you get a little lobster and I get a little steak and I can get a little surf and turf.
Yeah, that's it. It's just like, well, lobster's fancy, steak's fancy. Let's
Gruden's
do both.
Like, these things go down.
That's my attitude.
Yeah.
In the restaurants and on airplanes. Because I think they are essentially kind of a dumb idea. What we got was best case scenario. I think they go back to this well of a surf and turf idea because A, it's kind of hacky and dumb and also therefore challenging. And what was impressive about this challenge, and I'll go back to it again, I think it had to do with it being a double elimination that forced the collaborative creativity. The dream scenario is a show to Sarah combination. Mm-hmm. Not just, to my mind, the two best competitors teaming up and just getting along and broing out and just smoking everyone more than that smoked salmon. It's that they rethought what it could be and what mm-hmm. it meant, you know, and they had a fish that is really more complementary and more of a, use it as like a base ingredient, like you would normally use like an allium, like an onion or garlic or something, put it in almost everything. And the other team that did that was the other team that I think was pretty quickly made, you know, they were safe, which is the team that did it was the Avishar and Chris team where they did
they were doing like a fish and chips almost kind of.
Well, but they took the fish was the main course mm-hmm. and the game meat, in this case was venison, I think, was more like a fritter on the side of it, right? And so you're mm-hmm. sort of flipping the understanding of it. And that's, it's a big ask. They're always asking these chefs, they're basically like, we think that you're creative geniuses, be creative geniuses and totally reinvent something and surprise us in this ridiculous amount of time in pouring rain with rainbows blinding you when bees aren't stinging you.
Well, it's been an interesting like wrinkle, or not even a wrinkle, but a development this season, because I don't think it's been a very like new text or new criticism season, where I think everything that's on the plate is what gets judged, not any of the narrative going into it or coming out of it. Mm. So Jamie did not reveal that Gabriel encouraged her to not undercook her chicken wing, but just like that it should be right. like on the lighter side. She didn't throw him under the bus last week. And then this week, you know, I thought that the going into that meal, Gabriel kind of like set that surf and turf up. His concept, so to speak, was I'll make a good thing and you make a good thing. And that should be two good things on the plate and we're all set. So even though they cooked the fish too hard, and whether that was Nelson's fault or his knees or whatever, the pills wearing off, like ultimately, I think conceptually it was the last place dish, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was also a dish that you would make. I mean, he was acting like, whether he was aware of it or not, like he had immunity. Like, I'm just going to hide here on turf corner and let the surf go down, basically. It just wasn't a winning dish because they didn't go for it. At the end, all of a sudden, he had a good and creative idea about taking the fish skin and wrapping the meat in that, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it was a conceptual failure in addition to being a technical failure. And that's why it went the way it did.
Any magical mushrooms takes that you have for the elimination? Well, I know we're kind of jumping all over the place, but this was
it was inevitable that they were going to do a mushroom challenge. Gabriel, I mean, I imagine that Gabriel's face during the quickfire is similar to our faces during Mayor of Easttown, you know, whenever someone like orders a hoagie or drinks a Yingling. We're like, I know that beer. You know, we're making the Leonardo DiCaprio meme. So that was inevitable. The having them like cook over tiny tree stumps, like you guys just let them chop the mushrooms. You know what I mean? You don't need to get that cute. But what I did want to say, and it began in the beginning, was this might be a recurring segment until we get him on the podcast. But Chris, we got to talk about Tom, because Tom shows up for the quickfire and he immediately drops an all timer, which is, he says mushrooms are his favorite ingredient. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because, and this is a quote, they are as close as you can get to actually eating the earth.
Right.
Now, I want to press pause here on life and be like, was this the goal? Like, have I been approaching cooking, dining, feeding myself wrong for over 40 years now? Was I always trying to get closer to physically eating the planet that we live on? Because if so, I've made some terrible choices.
Okay, Galacticus,
Seriously. It's Galactus, but point taken.
I don't know whether what's more disturbing, Tom kind of never laughing or smiling this season, not being in it that much this season, or his hats.
Yeah, well, this is where we're going next, because then he shows up to this beautiful ceremony where the native hosts they look stunning and gorgeous. And once again, kudos to the show's producers for really doing the work and
incredible
reaching out
setting
to communities.
And this is at the Umatilla Indian Reservation, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation were hosting them. And it's this area, I guess, off the Columbia River. I've never been there, but I like need to go tomorrow.
It was beautiful. It was respectful. It was
educational. Cooking in a fucking rainbow, basically.
It's incredible. Yeah. And with that as the backdrop, Tom wears a shmata. Okay, Tom looks like he is a day player in Crossing Delancey.
Yeah.
Like, I am so confused by the thinking behind it, because at first I thought he was attempting to pay respects in some way by wearing the bag they harvested the duck potatoes in on his head to show that he values them. That was not the case. And then it became clear that he was wearing something because it was cold, and it clearly got colder.
Yeah, because they got like blankets on and everything.
Blankets.
Yeah.
But like, you know, I live in Southern California, so it's mostly warm. But even I know that there are different vessels for your skull to keep it warm, right? It was a choice at a certain point.
Yes.
It was incredible. It was really incredible.
It's a hat I haven't seen. It's a knit cap I have not seen since possibly Entourage.
Who would wear that in Entourage?
Oh, it was like that kind of hat was like the, I did a 3-episode arc on Supernatural. And like, you know, I have like a goatee, and I, you know, like I'm fighting with Adrian Grenier for
And I'm like courtside at a Clippers game.
Yeah, maybe. And sitting with my agent whose other like guest like fell through at the last second.
Frankie Muniz or something. Where's this hat?
Maybe, yeah.
Circa 2005.
Right. Yeah, I didn't really have anything like illuminating to say about the quick fire. I'm a fan of mushrooms. I'm sure those would have been delicious.
Do you? I was glad Gabriel got to have.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah. Okay.
Mushrooms.
Yeah.
Can they be the main character of the novel?
I mean, we're trying.
Are you?
As a culture,
people are working real hard to be like that. This is a mushroom dish. Rather than,
dude,
like, here's a side, you know, like, here's like a...
Bro, cauliflower needs a breather. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, imagine being cauliflower.
Personally, I've moved on to shredded carrots. So it's like...
Well, cauliflower spends the chillest century imaginable being like, we're good. We're just white broccoli. Nobody's that interested in us, but we're here if you need us.
Now we're steak. Then, now we're pizza crust.
All of
now
a sudden,
we're rice.
We are now the staple of cuisine that could be formed into anything. I mean, the stress levels must be off the chain. I mean, it's just the usage rate, to put it in NBA terms, right? So I appreciate mushroom being like, well, we just grow here, so it's fine. You lean on us. I think that we are easier to produce. Shouts to our brethren in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. Can it be good? Yeah, like I had an al pastor style mushroom taco here in Los Angeles the other day. It was very good. I love mushrooms.
No, they can. I'm not saying mushrooms aren't good. I just think that you're asking like Paul Giamatti to be Brad Pitt sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're asking the character actor to take the lead.
Well, in that case, Paul Giamatti's thrilled. am I worried about our palates, or am I worried about like the crops? Like, are we overly taxing them?
Look, that ship sailed for me.
My thing is perpetually. Now I realize that I said this about the Oscars. So I guess the stock room's a little low. We should be worried about crops.
Much like the mushroom supply.
But when you start replacing things for other things, I think is when you screw up. Like if you're cooking vegetarian, that's wonderful. And they're delicious traditions and food ways
of
preparations.
But you don't like replacement foods.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me. Like,
do you like an Impossible Burger?
I've never had it.
Never tried one?
No. Because you know why? You know why? Because on the menu, there's also a burger.
Not if you go to an Impossible Burger restaurant.
Right. So I will go next time in New York, I'll go to Superiority Burger, where they make a veggie burger that's apparently amazing. And it's a veggie burger. It's not like the third choice on the menu. You know what I mean? And also, it isn't made to be like, look, it bleeds.
So you're not into that.
For global health reasons and like,
I'm
we got to save
the
environment.
You don't have to worry about that. Yeah.
I'm saying I support the idea of like making ourselves and our planet healthier through food alternatives. But I've never walked into a sports bar and like perused the menu and been like, should I have a cheeseburger or an Impossible Burger? Because I'm trying to cut 17 calories because this fried hockey puck of science with cheese on it is marginally less saturated. I don't get it.
Kaya, do you like Impossible Burgers?
I've also never had an Impossible Burger.
Jesus.
I'm along the same thinking as Andy, where it's like, I don't really know what's in an Impossible Burger, but I do know what's in a real burger.
Yeah. Cow meat. Also, Kaya goes camping. So Kaya's tougher than both of us put together. She just eats the food.
This isn't a world's strongest man competition. I was just taking a room survey if you'd had Impossible Burger.
You are Leslie Knope. We are collectively Ron Swanson. Okay, Chris, have you had one? Do you like it?
Yeah, I like them. Yeah. I actually, and I find that I feel a little less like meat fever after, because, you know, like sometimes if you just like eat, I personally like a smash burger. Like if I could have my choice, I'm just going Shake Shack. I'm just going to get the smash burger. But I think my problem is I kind of fell out of love with burgers when it was more like pub burgers were the style.
Can't do that. No,
it was
thin,
just like, here's a giant patty with like a giant fucking brioche bun and 700 toppings. Like I was just kind of like, fam, like that's like a steak with bread. So yeah. I'm a smash burger dude. And then if I'm going to do anything a little bit bigger than that or different than that, I'll do Impossible Burger. I've tried to do Impossible smash burgers and there's just something missing.
Let me set the scene here because it was 2004. You and I and a couple of our friends went to see a reunited Fleetwood Mac at the Tweeter Center in New Jersey. In Camden, New Jersey. And great show, great night, a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that, I don't know whether it was us or our friends Max and Mara, like, brought food to enjoy in the parking lot. And I don't remember what the food was. I do remember you grabbing my arm and being like, I think I have meat sweats. You're like, I'm not well.
I think I ate a lot of chicken. And it wasn't
was it barbecue or something?
Yeah, what was the situation? Something. I think it was just like, it was like one of those things where we hadn't eaten all day.
Right.
And then there were all of a sudden buckets of food. This is probably terrible content.
No, but
and
my
I
point
was
is,
just like, and I was just like, I am now having visions because I have just communed with this bird, multiple birds here, and I'm like, now we have to go watch Lindsay Buckingham.
It's legitimate, and I will say that in an homage to your friendship advice style of the time, which was mostly based on Dr. House suggesting that someone puts a cold towel on things so they don't feel well, I think that I attempted to nurse you back to health through a 64-ounce concession Michelob or whatever. Which probably wasn't the right move. But
that's probably right.
All this is to say, I just feel like if you're going to do a cheeseburger, don't do it every day, but like do it. And then the other times, have a different dish based around mushrooms and cauliflower, which are also good.
Last point, last question.
Yeah.
Are Shota and Sarah the kindest, gentlest front runners in Top Chef history?
Team Tiny. The little buddies.
Even Melissa was a killer. You know what I mean? Like, Melissa had a little not here to make friends energy. Like, Brooke was a killer, you know?
Yep.
I think that this is kind of reminding me of Denver a little bit. Of, like, these people are just, like, sweethearts, and they really like each other.
Yes. I think it's definitely unique because all the people you're mentioning who won did have a switch to flip. And it was a switch that not only was good in a competitive situation or competitive cooking TV show, but also you could imagine that is kind of what it takes to survive in a high-stakes kitchen environment, right? Like, it doesn't have to be bullying and aggressive and traditionally macho, but it does have to be just savage. You just have to crush it, right?
Yeah.
The language of the kitchen are usually very violent words like that. Both Sarah and Shota are successful in their professional lives, but they are also super chill. I mean, her dream is to own a cannery? That's her dream?
Right.
Like, I can see that being a nice detour or a happy place to land. But that's her dream. Okay. No,
but it was wild to watch them. I, like, as soon as they paired up together, I was like, this is a wrap. Nobody
But can also, be. But, like, if Melissa and Gregory had teamed up during All-Stars, I think everyone else would have been sweating it, being like, well, that's done. That's right. A wrap. Everyone just likes them. And also, they didn't take their foot off the gas because they're better cooks. They did something that they were concerned about because it seemed so off the wall. But of course, it was exactly the right kind of off the wall to make everybody notice and be totally awed. So if anything, since we usually wrap up by saying this, like, I think their front runner status is affirmed.
Yeah, for sure affirmed. I guess I was just asking whether or not you felt like that lack of it factor or that X factor of that competitive edge, which I think will probably come out because even last night, or even this episode, I was saying to my, I was kind of surprised because I was like, oh, we have actually, like, gotten rid of a bunch of people. Like, now we are down to 4 or 5 people, all of whom I think have a chance of winning and are good, you know?
I was about to say that. It's getting late super early. I was taken aback as well as, like, when they were doing the quick fire, because usually there's some people's dishes you barely even see them get tasted because there just aren't enough people there.
Yeah.
No, we're already down. And then we lost 2 more chefs. Obviously, one's coming back. But in terms of who actually is a threat to win right now, I don't see it. Out of Shota, Sarah, and Gabe from Austin, I don't see it right now.
Yeah.
Show me more. Is that what an inspiring coach would say?
All right, well, we can wrap it up there. We'll be back on Monday to talk about Mayor of Easttown. But let's now get into my interview with Rob McElhenney, who is one of the co-creators of Mythic Quest, one of the co-creators of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and the star of both of those shows. And great conversation about making TV during COVID, about why he wanted to do this specific show and this specific season the way he did. And a really thoughtful conversation about growing up being a TV fan. So I hope people enjoy it. Check out Mythic Quest. It's on Apple TV this weekend, and we'll see you Monday.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from sports exploration and green energy to delivering pizza and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
Rob, thank you so much for joining me today. This is a little bit, I'm sure you're familiar with the Spider-Man meme with two guys pointing at each other, but it is sort of strange to be able to talk to another Philadelphian in his early to mid 40s who also went to Temple. So this is very exciting for me. I think we've really nailed this demographic.
If it makes you feel any better, I only went to Temple for like a month.
I only went for a year, so that's good.
We may have crossed paths on our way out.
So yeah, I was curious if we could start. I don't want to do too much of like a Marc Maron type startup here, but I wanted to kind of, as a fellow Philadelphian, and this is not a Philadelphia podcast per se, but as a fellow Philadelphian, I was kind of curious if you could tell me a little bit about growing up and what your relationship was to like film and TV as you were kind of growing up, and what shaped that in Philly particularly, because for me, obviously it was a very specific experience of going to like TLA and getting movies from certain video stores in the city or going to certain movie theaters. And, you know, we grew up at a time when TV wasn't considered like high art in the way I think it is now. But can you tell me a little bit about falling in love with storytelling in that way?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I love movies. I loved going to the movies. I loved going to West Coast Video. If you remember, yeah. West Coast Video before, sure. Well, before there was Blockbuster, there was West Coast Video on the East Coast, of course. And we would rent the tapes, and you know, the experience of going there with my brothers and sisters and my dad, and you'd spend an hour just, I mean, what I realized was he was killing time with kids. Now that I have my own, I'm like, right, you just find things to just like eat up the time until they can fall asleep sometimes. And so we would go, and if you remember the experience of like walking down the aisles and trying to pick out a movie, it was such a tactile experience as opposed to now where you're just skimming through on the screen. And it was communal in some ways, and it was really fun. And we'd go and pick out movies and come home and watch them. So I've always been a big movie fan, but I would say that my thing is TV, and always has been. It's always been my thing. Growing up, it was just something that we all did together at times. It was something that I looked towards for alone time. It was something that made me laugh or brought me laughs and brought me joy. And also oftentimes actually helps me get through difficult times and navigate difficult experiences. I think some people hear that and they think it's sad or shallow that I had moments of catharsis sitting alone watching other people on screen. But I disagree wholeheartedly. I found real solace in that. I would always feel less alone when I was finished with an episode of my favorite show. And then it was something I could talk about either with my brothers and sisters or my dad or my moms or my friends at school. So TV was always my thing.
Do you remember a show or even an episode of a show when you were growing up where you started to think about TV, not as like a companion, but as an art form, as like the storytelling that you were seeing on television, and you were starting to think more critically about, oh, when I watch NYPD Blue or when I watch Friends or something like that, they're doing something that other shows aren't doing.
Yes, distinctly. Golden Girls.
Oh, wow.
Golden Girls was one of my favorite shows. And it was one of my favorite shows because it was on every Saturday night and it was on at 9 o'clock. And I would only get to see my mother, my two mothers, every other weekend. And so when we went there, we would spend all day together. But at night, on Saturday nights, we would watch the Golden Girls together. And it was a really fun communal experience between my brother, my sister, my two mothers. And we were all laughing together, laughing at the same jokes. And then sometimes they would be laughing at jokes that we didn't really get. But we just absolutely loved those women and loved that show. And I think I was probably, and we would really look forward to it every Saturday for years. And then I remember as I was in my mid to late teens, or no, early to mid teens, I realized I was watching the same episode over and over and over again. That, you know, just like lots of TV shows, especially of that era, it was just the characters were Popeye, essentially. I am what I am, what I am, what I am, all the way through every single episode. And every time Blanche would say something, it was to demonstrate who she was. Every time Rose said something, it would be to further demonstrate who her character was, Sophia, and of course, Dorothy. And so I realized, like, wow, it's almost like they're taking a template and they're just rewriting lines of dialogue. And yet they're all kind of the same story over and over and over again, where they're learning the same things over and over and over again. And there was such a familiarity to it, to the structure itself. And yet I could recognize that it was a complete art form because they were making it different every week. And it wasn't the same joke, even though it was still Rose is sweet, but dumb. Blanche is oversexed. Dorothy is the straight person that's basically commenting on everything. And Sophia is the wild card who will say and do anything. Every single time they would say something, it was something different. For years they yeah. did this. And I thought, wow, there's somebody, are they making that up like every week? Because even at the time I thought, I don't know, maybe these women are so funny. I just didn't put the pieces together. California, Los Angeles, Hollywood, that was another planet as far as I was concerned. It just seemed like a bunch of funny women were getting in a room together and being funny. And so that was the first step. And then the second, that was like the book opening. Mm-hmm. And then the book sort of like slamming me in the face was Seinfeld, because I kept watching that show and seeing it be completely different than Golden Girls, where they were making anything they want. And it was every week was so different. And it was like a completely different way of telling a sitcom story, and was like deconstructing sitcoms in a lot of ways. And I kept seeing the same name over and over and over again, a name that I realized I wasn't looking for in other shows. And that was Larry David. And I would watch it and be like, who is this Larry David guy? And then I would go back and watch old episodes of shows that I loved. Golden Girls would be a good example of it. Family Ties. And I would look for who was the executive producer? Mm-hmm. Who are the writers? Who are the people that, you know, Susan Harris, who created the show, or Paul Junger Witt, or Gary David Goldberg? I would see these names and be like, right, there's more than just Michael J. Fox. There's more than just B. Arthur. There's more than just Jerry and Elaine. There are these people that are making these shows, and they live somewhere else.
It almost feels like, you know, when you grow up watching TV in that way, the sustainability and the longevity of a show is part of the appeal. And it's been interesting, you know, obviously I'm a huge Sunny fan, and it's been like a part of my life for more than a decade. And then you've got Mythic Quest, which definitely seems like it has legs. Like if you guys wanted to just keep doing Mythic Quest, like there's just endless amounts of different like variables you could throw in there. Do you think that like longevity is actually like an underappreciated component of television at this point? Because you see so many shows that are limited, or it's a kind of a mini series, or maybe we'll come back and do another, or it's like there's just three seasons.
I think what happens is that you have super creative people who want to try different things and mm-hmm. to do different things. And it used to be that you signed onto a television show and you weren't allowed to do anything else. You did 24 episodes of that show, which took you almost the entire year. And then you really weren't able to, whether you had even if you had the time contractually, you were not able to go and do other things. That's all gone now. Now the fact that we have the ability to only do 10 episodes a season of something, and the old way of doing things where we're holding back actors from and writers from other opportunities is dead. So now you can stretch your wings and go and try different things. And so that's really helpful for us. I know the way that we have sort of approached Sunny, which is, hey, we can make Sunny in 4 months. And then that allows us 8 months to go and do other things. And if even on Sunny, we continue to stretch, the characters don't learn or grow or change in any way. But we do as human beings. And then we try to challenge ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a challenge in and of itself just to try to make a new episode of Sunny every time we go out. But then we also have the opportunity to go and do other things. So like, I think that I hope that there are a lot of people out there who are making these series that people love, and then they continue to make them because they're gratified by continuing to make them, and that they don't feel creatively stifled by quote unquote doing the same thing every week. Because I don't think anybody would watch a season of Sunny and think, oh, well, they're just doing the same thing every week. I mean, we would stop making the show if that was the case.
You know, you mentioned earlier that you've often gone to television as like a kind of cathartic or a companion piece during tough times. And I was wondering whether or not your television viewing habits changed over the course of this last year, you know, with the pandemic and stuff, and whether or not you found yourself returning to shows that you already loved as a kind of like blanket, or whether or not you were like, shit, I have so much time. Like, I'm going to watch this show that I never seen. Now I have time to catch up on five seasons of X or Y or Z. Did you find a different television viewer during the last year?
I did. And a lot of it revolved around my children, actually, because my kids are now at an age 10 and 9 where we can watch a lot of the same content, and both of us, all of us, can really enjoy it. So I did introduce my children to Golden Girls. And that's been incredible because, full disclosure, Betty White is a neighbor of mine. And like, I would say that I do not get starstruck because I've been doing this for so long. I'm tongue-tied around her because she is a brilliant comedian, actor, but also because she has such a special place like in my heart that has nothing to do with her. Like, she doesn't have that relationship with me. I have that with her, which is always interesting.
Yeah.
Really interesting. But like, my kids know Betty White, and now they're watching Golden Girls and they're like, oh, that's Betty. We're like, no, that's Rose Nyland. That's a completely different person. But we also, that's been a really interesting thing to kind of watch TV through their eyes. Two kids who grew up with their parents doing this for a living, and how they sort of interact with their television shows. But we have been watching a lot of stuff together. So mm-hmm. The Simpsons, which I haven't watched consistently for many years, I'm now watching a lot more Simpsons because that's something that we can watch together, which has been great. And then they're introducing me to shows that I had never seen before. Adventure Time, which I'd never seen before, which is a brilliant show. And to be able to watch that with them. And then for every time they get to introduce a show to me, we introduce another show to them. So we started watching Amazing Stories, the original Amazing Stories from the 80s. Because I remember being 10 years old or even younger and watching that with my dad and having a really great communal experience. And so we went back and watched every one of those twice. And then they were like, oh, we want more of this. So I said, well, let's watch The Twilight Zone. And I remember The Twilight Zone, the reboot that they did in the 80s. So we watched that first. And then they were like, we want more of this. I said, let's go back and watch The Twilight Zone from the beginning. So we started the Rod Serling Twilight Zone from episode one.
Wow.
And we ripped through that. So we're all over the place as a family. But it's been a really great year for that kind of experience with us.
Tell me a little bit about the timeline of working on this second season and especially on the two specials. So when things shut down, I guess last March or so, where were you guys in? I think the first season aired in February, right, of 2020. And then had you guys started writing and thinking about the second season already? What was the sort of timeline there so that the listeners can understand the chronology?
Buddy, we had written an entire season, season two, and then we were shooting episode one of season two. And the last day of, and this was when the world was shutting down, certainly this country was shutting down. And I just remember we were on a beach in Malibu, and Charlotte and I, as Poppy and Ian, were on horseback doing this like promo for the game within the show. And I just was on the phone constantly with all of our advisors and trying to figure out what the right thing to do was. And finally, I remember just making the call, like, that's it. Cameras off, cut, we're going home. And we thought, well, you know, we have all the episodes banked. We'll just this is obviously very naive. This was in the early days of the pandemic. We thought, well, we'll just go down for 2 weeks or 3 weeks and then we'll come back and just pick it up. And yeah. We realized very quickly that that was not going to be the case, that the world was going to be different, completely different from that point forward. And it was dawning on us very slowly, but very seriously, that we had to throw that episode out that we shot and throw out the entire second season of Scripps because they didn't make any sense anymore. We couldn't make a season of a television show that didn't address the fact that we were living in the time that we were living in. Mm-hmm. So we started over. And during the pandemic, we made an episode in quarantine and then we wrote an entire second season of the show.
Okay. What was the impetus behind doing Everlight? Was that because you wanted to have like a kind of a bridge episode or a little bit more of a, you know, an optimistic kind of affirmative episode heading into the second season?
Yeah. So we left the characters having done an episode in quarantine, which was shot entirely in quarantine. Nobody left their homes. And we were dealing with the show the way that we always deal with the show, which is we want to make a relatable office comedy. And we want to make it funny and fun, but we also want to be authentic. And what was authentic to people's experiences was that it was fun and funny to navigate work life over mm-hmm. Zoom, but it was also really difficult and challenging. And there were mental health issues and issues of isolation and all sorts of things that were wrapped up in our shared experience, our shared global experience over the last year. And so we did that episode too, and it was really well received and people seemed to really dig it. And yet we knew that when we were writing the second season, we were going to be airing sometime in the spring or summer of 2021. And we knew even at the time, this wasn't going to be over, but we had an optimistic hope that we would be looking towards a future where it was over. And we kind of took the bet that people were going to be sick of talking about viral loads and quarantine and isolation. And they didn't want to hear the word COVID again. So we made it a challenge to ourselves to make a season of TV where we didn't say the word COVID once. We barely talk about the previous year because we felt like people weren't going to want that in what our show is and was. And yet we also felt like we couldn't just jump from quarantine into an optimistic future where COVID is in the rearview mirror without at least addressing the fact that that coming back to work is going to be an adjustment and it's going to be difficult for people, both practically and emotionally from a mental health perspective. So how do we navigate that in an episode that is the bookend to the quarantine episode? We're recognizing that COVID happened, the pandemic happened, and that we've now returned to work vaccinated and ready to start anew. And yet we wanted to feel authentic to the difficulties that people are going to go through. And then when it was over, that people would feel like we closed that book and have moved on.
Yeah. It's strange. I mean, like I've been watching like some SVU episodes where there's a lot of like mask on, mask off stuff that they're going through. And like, it's pretty disorienting. On one hand, I think that I crave, you know, to have like art that talks about the experience that we've all had over the year and to reflect it accurately. And on the other hand, I'm like, I really just want to watch SVU. You know what I mean? Like I really just want to see like a normal episode of television to take me away from the whole day that I've just had that is Zoom calls and masks and hand sanitizer.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the way we approached it, which was we did two episodes that I'm personally very proud of that I think address everything COVID that we possibly could. And now we're moving on. We're trying to move on.
I had an interesting reaction watching the second season, watching then the first two episodes, which go up soon. And I wanted to ask you something. I don't know if you get asked about a lot with Mythic Quest, which is the look of the show, because I realized that like, I found it very like, it was so great to see the characters that I love again. And it's so awesome to be back in this world. And I found myself obviously feeling somewhat like soothed or comforted by it, but the characters are all screaming at each other, like in a fun way, but like there's all this, you know, there's obviously like conflicts within this office. And, you know, in Sunny, just to talk about a show that you're obviously also heavily involved in, I think it's a grittier look, you know, it has like more of a handheld look. Obviously that might be somewhat of an extension of the origins of the show, of you guys just kind of making it yourselves and stuff. But, you know, Mythic Quest has such like a different tone and a different look. And I was wondering, if you could tell me a little bit about it, because for most viewers, I bet that's invisible. Like, I bet they don't notice how a show like Mythic Quest maybe looks per se, but I imagine it's something you put a lot of thought into.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We wanted it to make, we want Sunny by design has a very gritty feel to it. That it almost feels quote unquote homemade. That was something that we, that was out of necessity when we made it for the first time, because we made it at home. And then we just thought, oh, this kind of works. Let's just keep it going. And then we've actively tried to, make it look and feel like that all the way through. Whereas Mythic Quest, we wanted it to feel a little bit more cinematic and a little bit more beautiful, and then also a little bit more realistic, which I know sounds odd when you're also talking about making it cinematic. We just wanted it to, the characters from a tonal perspective, to feel like they really exist, like they're real human beings. Now, it's still a television show and it's a comedy, so you're talking about the extreme versions of people, but whereas Sunny is essentially a live action cartoon, those people do not exist, thankfully. those are cartoon characters because it's a satire, and that's the way that we're able to tell those kinds of stories that we do. Whereas that, I believe, would be irresponsible to tell the kind of stories we do in Mythic Quest the same way, because we are presenting these people as real human beings. And so there is change and growth in these characters, and there's room for growth, and there's room for catharsis, which just simply can't really exist in Sunny. I think we have maybe one moment of catharsis in the entire series of Sunny, whereas Mythic Quest, we're having them every episode.
Yeah.
And we wanted it to look like you were watching a movie. There are certain episodes, specifically in the first season of Mythic Quest, that I directed to look like a movie. A Dark Quiet Death, for example, which was the fifth episode of last season. And there's another one this year called Backstory that's shot. I tried to make it feel as much like a movie shot in the 70s as I possibly could.
Does that keep it fresh for you? Does that keep it fun for you to give yourself little challenges like that? Not little challenges, but challenges like that?
Yes. Yes. That's why I continue to do it. I mean, I love what I do for a living, and I recognize how privileged I am that I get to do it. And it's not going away. When I see or hear about people like, oh, go like laying by the pool, you know, on a Tuesday because they're not going to work. That's great. And I'm happy for them. I don't feel that. I remember when I was a kid on Sundays, I would get, it's like Sunday afternoon would come by and Sunday night, and you'd get that pit in your stomach because you had to go back to school.
Yeah. The Sunday scaries. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So miserable. I found that the last 15 years of my life on Sundays, I start to get really excited, and I didn't really recognize what that was. By Sunday night, I can't sleep. And I'm like, what is that? Why is that happening? And it's because I'm genuinely excited for Monday morning. I love it. I love it. I love doing it. I love the people I work with. I love that I'm living my dream. And so I don't take that for granted, which I see a lot of people doing, and it makes me sad. I love what I do, and I know that it will end, because it ends for everybody. And so I'm going to take full advantage of it as much as I can, and challenge myself and learn and surround myself with people way more talented than me, with differing points of view from differing backgrounds, who can help me become a better person and help me make better television.
You know, we've had different writers and different showrunners on the pod before, and it's always interesting when I feel like I've found somebody who is treating the show that they're working on currently as like the box that everything can go into. And I was wondering if you felt that way about Mythic Quest, where it's like any kind of writing or any kind of filmmaking you want to try can be contained with this format that you've come up with, or this story that you've come up with for Mythic Quest. And if you wanted to do an animated episode or an action adventure episode or a 1970s homage to, you know, whatever, that it can support that. Did you go into Mythic Quest? First of all, do you agree with me that that's the case for Mythic Quest? And did you go into it looking for something as malleable as that?
Yeah, that's a cool question. The answer is yes. The answer is no to the last part of your question. We went into it just thinking, hey, let's just write a funny show about a video game. Mm-hmm. But then what you find is like nothing is ever just, oh, let's just do something simple because it would be fun. When you sit down with other people and you start talking about what interests you and why you're doing it and what is the motivation not of the characters, but what is our motivation? Why are we in this room right now? Why are we talking about this? What is it that excites us about this? Why do we choose this profession over another profession? Why is it that we're all in this room together? You know, what was your life like? What was your relationship with your parents? What neighborhood did you grow up with? And, you know, what about being the ethnicity that you are informs your creative output? How can you tell me more about your experience so that I can understand where you're coming from? And then that makes me grow and become a better person. And then shit, how can we put this all in one television show? And right. That's what excites me. That's why I go to work every day at this point in my life. I go there, which I recognize is, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to do so. Is a ridiculous privilege. It is ridiculous that I can even say that's why I go to work every day, but it's true. And I get to sit there amongst really talented people and they get to tell me their stories. And then we try to figure out how we can tell those stories in 30 minutes or around that. And that's exciting to me. That's a challenge. And you have all of these tools at your disposal to do it in a completely different way. And because Sunny's been on for so long, we do versions of that with Sunny, but the template has been set, and it's difficult once you've like set that template to completely rewire a television show. Whereas this, from the very beginning of Mythic Quest, you'll see this season is much more experimental, even more so than the first. It's so exciting to be able to sit down and do that every day.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like Mythic is actually does some what my favorite kind of television does, which is, I guess it's like give you what you need by giving you what you want. Like what you want is like this, you know, this sitcom so that you can kind of return to these same characters and go to these familiar situations over and over again. But then at the end of an episode, you actually wind up coming away from it being like, oh, they tried this time. Or I didn't think that that character would get to lead their own episode ever or go in this direction. So it's a very exciting time for these kinds of shows. I've heard you talk about Atlanta and Fleabag and some other shows that are kind of messing around with the 30-minute model of like what we would call a comedy, but is in fact like anything you really want it to be. It must be a really exciting time to be working in this particular format.
There are just simply no rules. And it's just great when you work with studio partners who recognize that, and they want you to experiment and they want you to try new things and they want you to grow and expand and do something different. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's not a lot of pandering, at least in the conversations that I'm having, to the assumption that the global audience isn't going to quote unquote get mm-hmm. what you're trying to do. I think those days are long past us. We recognize that the audience is savvy and smart and they know what they like and they are as adventurous as we are. And if you present them with shit, they're not going to like it, whether it's experimental or not. But if you present them with something that's good, now that's a relative term. Everybody's got their, especially in comedy, everybody has their version of what that is. But I think what definitely shines through no matter what is effort. And if it's clear that people recognize the opportunity that they have, which is to be welcomed into your home or your phone or your whatever your day is, wherever you're traveling, if you're on a subway or a bus or sitting in your home, that you're welcoming those people into your life for 30 minutes, that is a privilege and an honor. And that if you are not taking that seriously, then they will turn you off and you will no longer become a part of their lives. But if you take that seriously and you do your best, I think that comes through. And I think that people can see that and they can feel that.
Do you get competitive with other shows at all? Like when you see something that you're like, ah, God damn it, I didn't think of that. Like, do you get spurred on?
100%. If anybody comes onto this show and tells you that they don't, they are lying. Of course. Look, there's good versions of that and there are toxic versions of that. The toxic version is the version that is competitive out of jealousy of the attention that another show might be getting or the marketing budget that another show might be getting. And of course, I'm guilty of that. Everybody is to a certain extent. But the really constructive version of that is when you see somebody do something and they just kind of blow your mind for a minute. And you say, oh, they're the only people that could have done that. Mm-hmm. What's my version of that? And it's so inspiring. You know, when you watch a show like Pen 15, or you watch a show like Broad City, or you watch a show like Atlanta, again, just naming comedies, but you watch those shows and you realize, oh, those are the only people that could make that show. And they could phone it in if they want, but they don't. They've decided that they want to keep stretching and growing and doing a weird version of what they can do. And it inspires me to continue to do the same and to not get stuck in the rut of just producing content, which is my least favorite word in our industry.
Well, man, I'm really excited for people to be able to see the second season of Mythic Quest. And I'm so glad you were able to join me finally. It was really great talking to you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Watch. We are produced, as always, by Kaya McMullen, and we are part of the Ringer Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid. Featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God, the world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.